Well, my guest in the studio tonight originated from Darwin. He's performed extensively throughout Australia and Europe, basing himself in London for 4 years. Following a Masters of Music, majoring in jazz, he taught performance, improvisation and composition at the Canberra School of Music, the Queensland Conservatorium of Music and the Queensland University of Technology. He's released 2 albums to date and is about to launch a third with his collaborative group, The Subterraneans. James Ryan, welcome to Now's the Time.
Hello, Frank. Thanks very much for having me. I'm sort of blushing after all that.
I said you grew up in Darwin. What was your musical inspiration up there?
Musical inspiration? Well, growing up in Darwin, I was just really lucky to have so many opportunities. Being a small town, and there was a lot of musicians who moved to Darwin to teach, but were actually, you know, very, very good, competent, not more than competent, talented musicians and inspirational. And I, well, being 15, 16, I got the opportunity to play with them. There weren't a lot of saxophone players at that stage living in Darwin, and before you knew it, I was doing a lot of professional gigs at the age of 15, 16 with these fantastic players. So Darwin was a great opportunity for me.
So it was groups coming through and you were Johnny on the spot.
I got the opportunity to do that. But I also got to play, you know, in professional bands in Darwin. Also with my mates, Alistair, and the guys who I was, you know, coming up with and learning to play with, we got opportunities to play music we really were just learning about and given so many opportunities because of that, which I find a contrast to people living in Sydney when there are so many people all wanting to be able to play music and there's only so many opportunities, which is a lot more difficult for people here in Sydney, I think.
Now, what about the tenor saxophone? It's an enormously popular instrument for people to pick up, young budding musicians. They can't all be doing it because of John Coltrane. What is it about the tenor saxophone that attracts young musicians, do you think?
I can't speak for other people, but I can say for myself it's the tradition. It's just such a humongous tradition, starting out from, you know, Lester Young to Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, and that's just...
So are they some of your influences, or...?
I'd like to say I've pretty much tried my best to check out as many tenor saxophone players as I can. So, I mean, I did my master's on the development of the tenor saxophone from 1939 to 1965, and which included pretty much a transcription of nearly all the major saxophone players during that period. Nearly. I mean, obviously, that's pretty impossible. There's a few people I'd like to check out more, like Don Byas, or there's a whole bunch more, of course, Lucky Thompson. But I've really tried my best. Gene Ammons, Jug, Yeah, there's just too many to name, but it's one of the inspirations is that there is such a massive, well, language within the tenor saxophone.
Richard Tognetti, one of the nation's most acclaimed musicians. Mm-hmm. Last year, he described the quality of music education in schools here as Neanderthal and urged its swift inclusion onto the national curriculum. How would you regard then Australia's, I guess, competence in that area as far as musical education in schools is concerned?
Well, it's a good question. I'd like there to be more music education. The education programs I'm involved with, sometimes I'd like to see, well, done a lot better. Sometimes there are some fantastic teachers out there who may be a little under-resourced, a little stressed out, who may not have as much support as they should have, but actually are really good teachers and, you know, give their all to their education.
You're still heavily involved with education as well? Or like I talk to a lot of musicians here in the studio, and the great bulk of them really have to rely heavily on education to sort of make means, rather than, and I get the feeling a lot of them would be prefer to be performing professionally.
That is not the case with me. I really enjoy teaching the people I teach. Mm-hmm. I believe I get a lot from teaching them, as much as they get from me. So, I chose to be a teacher, to teach the students I teach, and I try and give them whatever I can. And, you know, and hence I've got students who I'm really proud of. The last... We in the Wangaratta saxophone competition, first, second and third, were all ex-students of mine. You know, I'm very proud of my students.
So you'd know Zach Curran fairly well then?
I do indeed.
Yeah, he's a great player, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Jacob Manrix, Phil Noy, wonderful. Yeah. But also I've got a young fella as well, Chris O'Day, who's now 17. Uh-huh. He plays the life out of the saxophone. He's going to be very, very well regarded, I think, if he keeps going.
And his name again?
Chris O'Day.
Chris O'Day.
And he's only 17.
Mark that name down. And James, I guess you're, for want of a better word, the leader of the group. Is it more of a collaboration? You're the main writer on this particular album.
I am indeed. Mm. You would say I'm the band leader, but wow, it wouldn't be the band without those fellas in it.
Portobello Road. What have you got to say about this one?
Well, I lived in London, as we were talking about, particularly in West London for about 4 years. Portobello Road is one of the major roads in Notting Hill, Notting Hill Gate, where all the markets are during the weekend. And going through there, you just hear this, you know, reggae music and all this different music coming around. And, well, that sort of influenced this track.
I mean, clearly this music is quite diverse on this album, but essentially it's, for want of a better word, jazz rock or fusion. What do you think of the term fusion?
Well, it's got a lot of different imageries, hasn't it?
Mm.
You can say fusion as in the amazing music put out by, I don't know, Miles Davis, you know, Bitches Brew. What an album. Apparently, as it's been described, the first shot in the direction of fusion. It's an amazing album. Or you can think of Lee Ritenour, which is also called fusion,
yeah.
Which is nothing against Lee. I mean, what am I to say? But it's not my favourite type of music. And so I wouldn't call our music fusion as much because, unless it's, say, you're thinking of more of the Miles Davis side of it.
Yes.
Say, Tony Williams' Emergency Life, you know.
Lifetime.
All that Lifetime.
Mm.
But actually, the influences which come across for my influences for writing these songs is more Bob Marley, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, and also actually a whole bag full of Australian rock.
Yeah,
from the 80s, from when I was growing up.
So it's coming more from a rock background.
I even tend to call it rock jazz, to jazz rock.
Oh, that's an interesting twist then.
Mm.
Because that term hasn't really been coined a lot, has it, in the past?
Yeah, not
if
so
at
much.
All.
But,
yeah.
I mean, these are just boxes in the end. But
yeah.
I suppose in a way it helps describe somewhat, you know, what you're doing. But, yeah, I'd say there's actually more rock influences or those sort of 80s, 70s influences in it than actual, you might say, jazz.
I had a feeling that the whole idea of this type of music, or probably more so fusion, was maybe having a second resurgence to a certain degree. I noticed Cindy Blackman's just put out a tribute album to Tony Williams called Another Lifetime, and I hear about Dale Barlow going on tour with a Weather Report tribute.
Now, is it actually, you know, working on the fusion angle or is it working on the tribute angle?
Because, that's the question.
A lot of us are going to be very interested in seeing a tribute to something, but I'd actually rather see people doing their own original music. That's far more interesting to me.
Yes.
But it's going to be a lot more difficult to sell.
What do you think holds that back?
Well, you know, say, like, if you're using Tony Williams's name to sell something, everyone knows who Tony Williams is. You know, he spent his whole career building up that name. And then for someone else to start you saying, hey, I'm doing a tribute show to that, it's like, wow, it's really easy to market, isn't it?
So you're saying that the energy is then focused on something that's already known rather than focusing on something that's original?
It's focusing on someone else's work.
The energy in the market?
And it can be done very well. You know, exceptionally well.
Yeah.
But I.
So you think that then the resources are taken away, I guess, from the areas that, you know, could be focusing on more original music, and the resources are then placed towards a tribute rather than the...
I don't know. I mean, is it really a tribute to go and take someone else's music and perform it? Maybe it might be more of a tribute to the great creative geniuses out there to actually go and do your own thing. But that's, you know, maybe that's just a thought about it.
It's an interesting question, and it's one that I've posed to a few artists recently on the program, and it's always good to get a different perspective on that question of the idea of doing a tribute to another artist and sort of putting that person up on a pedestal rather than coming along and presenting your own music. And, you know, who knows, you could be in that same position down the track yourself.
Well, you know, it's a difficult one. I do know there are a lot of very talented musicians out there who do specifically put tributes together so they can get a gig. And they're very, very, very fine musicians.
This band that you've put together, you must be very happy with this. Are you ever surprised about how far these guys take your music? Let's go through them. They're Steve Hunter on the bass, well known to listeners of this program, along with James Muller, the powerhouse on guitar, and then of course James Hauptmann, also very well known to listeners on this program, on the drums.
All amazing musicians. I'm very lucky.
Are you ever surprised about where this music of yours goes in the hands of these fellas?
Surprised. No, I enjoy it. It's a journey. It's like the music isn't such that it's like it must be played this way every single time. We've been playing at the Town Hall in Newtown every Sunday night, and every gig is different.
Mm.
And that's wonderful, and that's what I look for in a performance. Otherwise, doesn't it in the end become like a staged performance? Like, now you're going to do this, now you're going to do that. It's far more interesting to, you know, roll the dice, as I like to think, and see what happens.
Yeah.
And with these musicians, and, you know, it's such an opportunity to do that.
Them's the Breaks. Tell us about that one.
Them's the breaks. Well, I usually, well, at a live gig, I usually play this at the end of the second set, being that the gigs we play are three-set gigs, which are, by the end of that, we're pretty knackered. So we play this at the end of the second set, and originally, you may not hear it, but I actually did try to write a hip-hop pop song, but it went really askew. And that's where the guitar riff at the very beginning, that came to my head because the sound of, well, if you're a musician, you leave your mobile phone on next to your guitar amp, and before the phone starts ringing, it starts going, ding, 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 ding,
oh,
ding,
yeah,
ding,
yeah,
ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding. Uh-huh. That's the rhythm of guitar sound.
Okay.
Guitar intro. But anyway, they're two of the things where it sort of came from, and then it went somewhere else.
When it comes to your musical performance and live musical performance, James, how do you gauge personally the success after every performance?
You're asking some good questions, Frank. It's so intangible. It's so hard to tell. It depends on what the performance was. Obviously, you know, when you're performing on stage, it's great to hear an audience response. It's great to have people clapping. But, you know, it depends on what mood you're in as well. If, you know, you might be in a bad mood and you've got to do a gig anyway and get up there and it's like, yeah, well, okay.
Do you ever come off stage thinking that you didn't do too well and someone comes up and says, wow, that was just sensational?
Yep, I've had gigs only a couple of weeks ago. I was actually feeling pretty down about it. And, yeah, apparently people like, but who knows what other people are looking for in music, and how do you provide that for them? I don't know.
I was reading a Downbeat article a year or so back, and it was Dave Liebman was being interviewed with Joe Lovano and, you know, guys like that. And Dave was talking about this time when he went up to Coltrane, you know, and it was might have been the Vanguard or something back in the 60s, and he's come off the stage and, you know, he feels as though he's just got to go back to the drawing board. This is Coltrane, you know. And Dave just said it was just a magnificent, out-of-sight type performance, you know. That's the thinking behind that sort of question, because sometimes your own perception of and your own measure of success is totally different to what the audience has just experienced.
Yeah, and it's also like trying to do you achieve the goals you're trying to achieve with your music, you know, like when you play this piece of music, is it, you know, going where it wanted? Was the musician, was the comradeship with the band, was the whole band vibing? You know, I always think that, you know, one of the most important things in a gig is actually getting the drummer behind you, getting the drummer into it, you know, because it's a damn hard gig if he isn't.
Especially when you're, you know, this high energy type music that you're playing as well. James, what are the other big issues for jazz musicians at the moment, especially in say Sydney?
Trying to get attention to it, I find there is one issue which comes to mind at the moment is that apparently I'm told by a lot of musicians is there isn't enough gigs.
Even with the recent relaxation in licensing laws, and an opening of a new venue, we're only really replacing, you know, a venue that may have closed a few years back anyway.
That's true. Mm. But those sort of gigs are great. You know, we're talking about 505, Jazz Groove and SEMA. Those organisations and venues are essential for the development of the music and it's for the survival of the music. But I'm talking about gigs outside of places where you have to sit down, be quiet and listen to the music, which are so important. I want the music to be out in the public, not hidden away in little places which, oh, well, that's where you go to hear jazz. I want to be in the public face. Yeah. I don't want jazz to be this archived sort of music like classical music can become. And, I, you know,
group like this and sounds like this, I don't see any problem with promoters being able to mix that in large outdoor concerts that are more aimed at younger people, like the Big Day Out, for example.
I truly hope so.
I mean, I think a guitarist like James Muller would blow a lot of that audience away.
Well, with our recent string of gigs at the Town Hall, you know, we are developing a very disparate or very diverse audience. You know, we're getting guys coming from, oh man, I was just, you know, playing in a country band down the road and I walked past and I went, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
And, you know, he comes straight up to me, buys me a CD, gets on the email list. I also, that's just last Sunday. But at the same time, I had another dude who just came in 5 weeks ago, was, you know, really loved it and just found out we're on again and he doesn't like jazz at all.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to, you know, develop a broader audience and not be just, you know, if you're just pitching the music at the jazz audience, it's can be really limited.
Because these sounds are much wider than that, as you've already described. Well, James, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.